This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 10th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we're in Venice for a special edition from the 14th International Architecture Exhibition. First up, we visit the IC-inspired and accomplished exhibition at the Architect Pavilion, the first time a continent has ever been represented at the Biennale.
If you look at the sort of bases built in Antarctica, they represent the kind of height of engineering, in a sense. They're pseudo-architecture. They're all about satisfying certain technical conditions for keeping people warm and not frostbitten.
We meet Min-Suk Cho, the architect and curator of this year's Korea Pavilion, which won the Golden Lion Award for Best National Pavilion at the Biennale.
He's asking to look back, which is not for being nostalgic of our glory days, obviously, to move forward. That was a sort of a no-brainer.
And we discuss the ever-important role architecture has to play as a soft power tool with a Brazilian diplomat turned architecture curator at the summer-long biennial Architecture Bonanza.
I think Brazil should stress much more its architectural legacy, its talent in architecture, because it shows it's a very contemporary country, a country that has a lot to say, and a country that can have an international influence, a soft power.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. It's said that when the Antarctic and Arctic ice caps melt at either end of the Earth, the watery world of Venice will disappear. This sad fact makes the appearance of the first ever Antarctic Pavilion at this year's Biennale even more pertinent. The show pulls together the real and the hypothetical, showing off some of the few pieces of architecture that already exist on Antarctica, as well as proposed buildings to be constructed in the future, such as Studio Zaha Hadid Vienna's idea for a research facility. Curator of the show, Nadim Samam, introduced the pavilion to me, the first time a whole continent has ever been represented at Venice.
We're in the Antarctic Pavilion in Venice, the Venice Architecture Biennale, and in a sense it's a counterintuitive proposition. Antarctica is a place that isn't owned by any particular national government, all sovereign claims are suspended. So who are we to claim to represent Antarctica? And I think what we are is we're enthusiasts for the idea that Antarctica belongs to everyone. I think that's the first principle. And if it really does belong to everyone, then the ways in which it's represented, the ways in which its potential is communicated, aren't the sole province of, let's say, the national scientific organizations that sort of operate there. So if Antarctica is for everyone, then other people, all of us, can speak for it in one way. And so this exhibition is a kind of polemic that says, okay, if we who sort of aren't institutionally kind of involved in Antarctica have a stake, then what do we want to say when all the parameters and all the kind of limitations, you know, economic or political, are just sort of put aside for one moment? You know, what would we build if even gravity didn't apply for a second, or if we didn't have to ship in oil to fund our machines? So I think, you know, for instance, an artist like Alexander Brodsky proposes a chess pavilion, because chess requires what he calls icy impenetrability and absolute silence of the game. So Antarctica is an ideal place to play chess. It's funny, I told him yesterday, I once read in a PhD thesis on living in Antarctica that a Russian on a base once cleft another man's head in two with an axe after losing a game of chess in Antarctica. So, you know, we're picking up on some vibrations here. So on the one hand, that's a really poetic proposition, but it sort of talks about a poetry of the space. Mm. But on the other hand, we have some really concrete and potentially practical ideas in the exhibition. So, for instance, we have Veach Media Architecture from Vienna proposing a new sort of master plan for how bases could sort of be powered, for example. They say that the reliance on fossil fuels in Antarctica is a kind of a relic of an age that we need to supersede. So what about harnessing solar power more effectively and the emergent technology of space-based solar power? So we're talking huge solar disks that kind of reflect sunlight directly down to Earth, and then they're caught in a kind of a catchment device, which would then power a series of bases as airships that float above the landscape, so they have no impact on it. It seems wild. But at the same time, you know, this is all through reference to existing technologies that could furnish those kind of possibilities in the future. Mm. So we've called the exhibition Antarctopia. You know, Antarctica is a space of possibility, of promise, a place that demands a variety of ways, you know, to engage with it. It's not just one thing. Antarctica is many things, and, you know, we all have a stake in it.
One of the standout pieces in the icy cool sanctuary of the pavilion is a model of the Halley 6 research station, the award-winning facility designed by British architect Hugh Broughton. As one of the few examples of a brave project that's actually seen the light of day down there, Hugh discussed with me the challenges of building in the cold.
The cold is kind of like, you know, that's obviously one of the big challenges, and the temperature does go down to around minus 50 in the depths of the winter. But to be honest, the biggest challenge is Halley, related to the fact that it's on this floating ice shelf, because the ice shelf is constantly moving out from the main continent at a rate of around kind of 400 meters per annum. And there's the constant risk of that ice breaking off as an iceberg. And the previous five Halley stations have either all had to be removed or they've disappeared on an iceberg. And so our brief for this project was to design the first relocatable station. So whenever there was the risk of it disappearing on an iceberg, the building could be dragged inland to a new, safer spot. That was really one of the key elements in determining the design of the station.
So how did you do it? I mean, it's a sort of modular system, isn't it?
Yeah, the modular decision was the kind of key decision to break the station down into eight separate modules, each supported on giant hydraulic legs. The hydraulics are there to help the building sort of lift itself out of rising snow levels. And those legs are supported on giant skis. So in essence, you can disconnect one module from another, lower it down on the hydraulics, and then pull it using a bulldozer on its skis to a new safer location inland. So it's sort of the ultimate mobile home, really.
I imagine very few architects in the world are sort of adept and expert enough to take on a project like this. Do you have had experience of creating something like this in those sorts of conditions before?
I had no experience whatsoever. At the point that we won the competition to design Halley 6, the largest building we had designed was a regional headquarters for Girl Guides in Wimbledon, which was a building of 200 square metres in a garden backsite. But the most brilliant thing about the competition for the design of this station was that nobody else had any experience either. So people might have the world's best art galleries and airports in their portfolio, but no one could offer up an Antarctic research station. So it really was a clean sheet of paper, and who could come up with the best idea, which the British Antarctic Survey recognised would serve their needs the best. And, you know, in that respect, it was a relatively unique competition, which I guess we came up with the right idea at the right moment.
This year's Biennale focuses on the architectural heritage of each nation involved, with the Antarctic not being a nation at all, much less one with a strong architectural legacy. How does Nadeem see this pavilion fitting in with the Biennale at large?
Well, there was, I think, a phrase about absorbing modernity. And if you think about it, Antarctica, in terms of man's involvement with it, it is the modern site par excellence. Like, we've only been visiting there for just over 100 years or so. All the early explorations were so bound up in the height of technological advancement. You know, I mean, the history of photography, for example, runs almost parallel with the history of Antarctic exploration, hence Ponting's photographs and films being such a big thing. So if you look at, you know, the sort of bases built in Antarctica, they represent the kind of height of engineering, in a sense. But they're not architecture, most of them, you know. They're pseudo-architecture. They're all about satisfying certain technical conditions for keeping people warm and not frostbitten, for example. I think Hugh's the only architect, really, until very recently, who has actually thought about, you know, what is it like to live in this space? You know, how can we make this a more amenable kind of campus for the inhabitants? And what are the possibilities of an architecture in Antarctica? Mm. So I think Antarctica is a place which is always absorbing our modernity. Think about the particles of soot in the ice. It's absorbing our modernity, which I think is interesting. We're not necessarily absorbing it, until now. I think, you know, we need to now think more about how Antarctica figures in our world. You know, when the ice sheets of Antarctica fully melt, Venice will sink. And so now we need to engage more with that kind of thinking.
That was Nadeem Samam, the curator of the Antarctic Pavilion at the Venice Biennale, talking to me there. Directed by Rem Koolhaas, the theme of this year's Biennale is fundamentals, a concept that sets to take the industry back to basics, making the six-month-long event about architecture, not architects. This year, a record-breaking 65 nations presented pavilions at the Biennale, united by the theme that Koolhaas set of absorbing modernity, 1914 to 2014, which essentially set to demonstrate how national characteristics in architecture have been slowly erased over the last 100 years of modernism. Everyone from Brazil to Morocco participated, who we'll hear from later. But now, let's meet winner of the coveted Golden Lion Award for Best National Pavilion. Min-Suk Cho is the director of Mass Studies, the world-renowned architecture studio in Seoul. He was the curator of the exhibition at the Korea Pavilion, entitled A Crow's Eye View, the Korean Peninsula. He sought to demonstrate how architecture both unites and separates the two nations of North and South Korea. I caught up with him a couple of hours after he won the award to discuss the challenges he faced pulling off this complex but thoughtful winning presentation.
We thought it was brilliant in a way that he's asking to look back, which is not for being nostalgic of our glory days, obviously, to move forward. That was a sort of a no-brainer. And we were actually thought it was so appropriate for a country like South Korea because we've been very good at moving forward, but maybe not so much with the reflections or evaluations and so on. And I think it was a very timely task that he imposed on. Korean Peninsula has been divided last 69 years. It was just obvious that we had to look at the both sides of the story. If we cannot create the whole as a sort of cohesive whole, at least we have to have these two voices. First ambition was quite a challenging one, which is to directly communicate with North Koreans. Initially, I was given a role as a commissioner, so I pictured something very simple exhibition, we somehow managed to give a role, one curator from North, one curator from South, and they probably would have to have a very polite and serious discussions about what to highlight together as a common subject, and then show something very plain as models and drawings, for example, with the two flags hanging in front of this pavilion, which I got full support from South Korean government. You probably know that we cannot make a direct communication to North Koreans, although we are so close. So we end up meeting various people who develop an interest and positive relationship with the North Korean through exhibitions, through writings, researches, through photographing things. So they become our bridging role or mediator. So this one curator, Pei Hyung-min, which is a serious thinker and a theoretician and writer in architecture, he was really an important part. He took important part in constructing the narrative, which is highlighting not the division, it's already a dramatic subject, but highlighting and identifying the common interest. So there are three chapters: reconstructing life, which is about these two post-war recovery process through building cities and buildings, and then the monumental state, which is about this heroic architecture in both cases, and both are, you know, the kind of complementary part. And then the third is the one that is about the construct that is actually we, North and South, created together, which although they didn't mean to create together, which is a border, which is mainly about the DMZ. So, but of course, other border through the eyes of various ways that it's not this cliche that's perpetuated as this most militarized border in the world, but highlighting different possibilities through observing different ways of transgressing and documenting various histories about that as well. And then the last part was It's On, It's On, which is through this British who become our substitute North Korean friend, or I should say, best mutual friend we have, who's been engaging in a fantastic way for the last 21 years without being the, I'm the Christopher Columbus like a lot of people do, but really has a substantial understanding and also has his own individual, as an individual take on, and as a creative individual, because he was a landscape architect by training, and he's a visual also person, so he has been incredible, a source, but also sort of guardians through the exhibition, but we kind of assigned the one room separate for him, for his collection, which has to do with what architecture and the whole construction process of architecture and city can mean for North Korean people. So it's I think it's which will perform as a fantastic window to look into.
That was architect Min-Suk Cho, curator of this year's winning Korea Pavilion, talking to me there. More from Venice after this.
For over six decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. We're in Venice for a special edition on the 14th International Architecture Exhibition. With a focus on nationality at this year's Biennale and the question of national style in architecture, soft power was naturally a hot topic. No less so at the Brazil Pavilion, whose exhibition was curated by André Correia do Lago. Instead of being a practicing architect, as is usually the case, André happens to be the Brazilian ambassador to Japan and has worked in diplomacy since 1983. With the theme of modernity as tradition, the pavilion he curated demonstrated how architecture has helped strengthen Brazil's national identity on a global scale. An imagery of stunning creations by Oscar Niemeyer and Linda Bobardi were aplenty. André started by telling me how he summed up a hugely complex 100 years of building in just one pavilion, especially for a nation like Brazil.
Mm-hmm. That's a big challenge to put 100 years in there, because the first issue is that people know very little about Brazil. So when, for instance, Germany or France or the US want to tell a story, anybody that enters the pavilion already has enormous information on that country. We have to start a bit from the beginning. And so sometimes it's we have to do it in a way that is not too boring, but we have to tell the story of the country at the same time, because people know very, very little about Brazil.
Yeah.
So it was very difficult.
As the Earth's eyes turned to Brazil ahead of the World Cup, diplomat André also explained to me the role that architecture has as a soft power tool, just like sport.
Now, architecture in Brazil today, I think, should be more important. It is very important, but it could be even more important, because I think that with music and football, it's one of the three things that have more impacted the world internationally. Because we have, obviously, every country has its culture, but very few countries have a culture that has an influence on other cultures. And for a developing country, Brazil is probably one of the very few that had an impact on the mainstream of an important art such as architecture or music. So I think Brazil should stress much more its architectural legacy and should stress much more its talent in architecture, because it shows it's a very contemporary country, a country that has a lot to say, and a country that can have an international influence, a soft power, as you were saying.
So compared to the United Nations, how does the meeting of nations that takes place in the Giardini in Venice every second summer compare?
Well, yes, I'm a diplomat, so I've worked a lot with multilateral meetings with the United Nations, etc. What is the enormous difference between here and an international negotiation? Is that in an international negotiation, every country has the same rights. He has one vote, he has the same time to speak, he has to be respected in the same circumstance. This is completely different because, first of all, obviously, depending on the country, you have a much bigger budget, you have a much bigger pavilion, etc. I think it's very challenging exactly because of that, because I learned a lot in this process to try to see how can you explain better how difficult it is for people to understand the difference of Brazilian architecture or to understand Brazil. It's very difficult. But it's very challenging, and it's worth it because the architecture is fantastic, so it's worth doing it.
That was André Correia do Lago, diplomat and curator of the Brazil Pavilion at the Venice Biennale. The director of this Biennale, Rem Koolhaas, made clear how he hopes this year's edition will illuminate the past, present, and crucially the future of the discipline of architecture. It was somehow fitting then that the main sponsor of the show was Rolex. In 2002, it launched its Mentor and Protégé programme, a philanthropic initiative that aims to pair up young, gifted creatives with expert masters in the fields of art, music, literature, and theatre. In 2012, it started its architectural programme and has since matched architects Alvaro Siza, Sanas Kazuo Sejima, and most recently Peter Zumthor with young protégés. During the Biennale, I met with Rebecca Irvin, who leads the initiative, to find out how Rolex aims to foster the next generation of architects.
We set up this programme, it's a philanthropy that we set up over 10 years ago, with the idea of reviving the traditional concept of mentoring in the arts. We're intrigued by how art gets done and how creativity is transmitted from one generation to the next. So we set this program up to serve all the arts. So we've been working in a variety of fields from dance, film, literature, music. And in 2012, we decided to set up architecture as a separate discipline. We started with Kazuo Sejima, who worked with a Chinese architect, Yang Zhao, who actually they worked on a project together in Japan, the Home for All project. He built one of the Home for All community centers, which was a group of Japanese architects had gotten together to build community centers for communities that had been devastated by the tsunami. So this was a very interesting experience where this Chinese architect went into this community and built a center for them, and they apparently loved it and it was very successful. And this year our mentor is Peter Zumthor, and he's just chosen his protege, who is from Paraguay, Gloria Cabral, and they're planning on doing various things together. She'll be spending time at his studio, his office in Haldenstein in Switzerland. He also wants her to go to Korea with him, where he's building a chapel, so she'll be working on that project. So she's a very talented architect who's been in a practice for the last 8 to 10 years in Paraguay, in Asunción. But this obviously is going to really expand her horizons, and she'll get a lot of interesting experience with him.
How do the architects go about selecting their protégés?
Well, the architects do what all of our mentors do. When we contact a mentor and recruit a mentor, we ask them what kind of protégé they want. This can vary. It can be something very general. It can be very specific. Mira Nair was one of our film mentors, and she said, I want to help filmmakers from Asia or Africa. So we had to find nominators that understood and knew young people in Asia and Africa. So we set up a separate nominating panel for each mentor. They're tailor-made mentorships. We're kind of matchmaking. We're trying to find the best combination of mentor and protégé according to the profile they give us. And then those nominators, they nominate young people, they meet and select three finalists, and the finalists actually go and meet the mentor, and he or she chooses who they want to work with. Mm-hmm. So it's an independent selection process, but they do have a choice. The candidates come from all over the world. It's extremely international. This year, we have a Swiss and a Paraguayan in the case of architecture. In visual arts, it's Olafur Eliasson, who's Danish, Icelandic, and his protégé is from Congo. In music, it's Kaya Sarriaho. She's Finnish. Her protégé is Portuguese. So it's really very interesting. It's a dialogue and exchange, not only across generations, but across cultures and borders, which has been fascinating.
And is it a sort of year-long project, or do they select and work on one, in the case of architecture, one building project, when that's complete, it's final and ended, or how does it work?
We define the mentoring period as 1 year, basically from June to June. So it's just started, our new cycle has just started. We don't actually specifically ask for an output. There's no strings attached. They can do whatever they want together. That being said, particularly in the case of architecture, or film for that matter, there's some disciplines where in order for the mentorship to work, they have to be doing something. They have to be working really on a project. But there's no formal output required on our side. That being said, sometimes the mentor and protégé decide to do something together. In the case of the Sejima as the mentor, that actually culminated in the inauguration of that community center.
Do you believe that element of apprenticeship and mentoring is missing from architecture today?
Well, architecture is a specific case, because there is kind of an apprentice system. I mean, most practices have lots of young people working there. I think that's kind of standard, that a young architect works with someone else. So it was very important for us to say that this is not just an extra body in your office who's working for you for free, or at least paid by the Rolex stipend. It has to go beyond that. And I think we've managed to do that. So our protégés tend to be young professionals who already have a certain body of work. And so far it's worked, because it's more of a professional dialogue from one to one than just having somebody else working in the office. I think that there's already kind of an apprenticeship system in place. But I would say that a young architect who's really starting out, they absolutely need older role models. They need to understand. We found in our mentoring program that in all the disciplines, what's very interesting, it's not just technical skill, but it's also, you know, how do you deal with a client? How do you deal with a gallery? How do you deal with a manager? How do you get an agent? How do you deal with an orchestra or a conductor that you don't necessarily like or you don't get along with? So our protégés are learning these kind of life lessons that are really important guidance of how you live your life as an artist.
Well, Rolex does a lot of work across all the cultural spheres, but this year is a particularly important year for the Biennale in architecture. What does architecture mean to the company?
There are some parallels between architecture and watchmaking, in that we're both interested in objects that have form and function, but that are also beautiful and aesthetic and are used by people. Also, what's interesting about architecture, it's really a marriage between both arts and the sciences and technology, and we're interested in those areas. I think that in Biennale, we're very pleased the way it's developed. It's become really the place for architects to meet. It's become the main architectural forum in the world. We've been a client. We've commissioned our own headquarters and our own buildings in Geneva from local architects, from Swiss and local architects. But we've also commissioned some international buildings. Our watchmaking school in Pennsylvania in the United States was done by Michael Graves. We have an after-sales service center in Tokyo done by Fumihiko Maki. And I think Rolex is quite well known now because of the Rolex Learning Center. We weren't the client, but we were the main private sponsor of this incredible library at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne, which was done by Sana. I think that that's probably one of the strongest statements of our interest in architecture, was the Rolex Learning Center. And so we're really thrilled to be here. I think this is it's a unique discussion and a unique meeting place on architecture, and we feel it's really important.
Rolex's Rebecca Irvin talking to me there. Out of the 65 nations presenting pavilions at this year's show, 10 are showing for the first time, including Turkey, New Zealand, Kenya and Costa Rica. One of the most interesting of the new nations was Morocco, whose presentation was curated by architect and urban planner Tariq Oulalou. Standing on a bed of sand in the darkened pavilion in the Arsenale, Tariq discussed the theme of the Morocco pavilion to me, entitled Fundamentalisms, and the complexities and opportunities of showing at Venice for the very first time.
When we discussed this with Rem, we thought it was a fantastic way to rejuvenate the Biennale, that the last few ones have been really unexciting. And Rem's grandiose approach, which is doomed to fail, by the way, I mean, of recreating a history of modernism through the lens of every country, was very fascinating because it obliged all of us to look inward and outward at the same time. And in a way, it's both absorbing modernity, but also absorbing OMA, in a sense. Because if you look at the curators of every pavilion, they all have, in one way or another, a relationship to OMA. So it's not just about the countries, but also about the way Rem's changed the culture of architecture and changed the way people look at it. And that's a strong part of the coherence, I guess, of this Biennale. So it's fascinating in its coherence because of the people who did it. But we also wanted to criticize it a little bit because we were afraid it would be such a didactic Biennale. And we wanted to show that the historical approach has to be connected to contemporary production. So the Pavilion of Morocco is both historical trajectory and a contemporary snapshot, if you will.
Do you think it's useful or even possible to sort of trace, in this particular example, a Moroccanness of architecture? And do you think that's what most pavilions are trying to do?
I think the Moroccanness isn't in the style, isn't in the form. It's in the way Moroccan architecture absorbed the influences that came. And that's what this is showing. You can sense where it comes from, but you don't really control where it goes. And each of these projects is exactly this. And by the way, the Moroccanist would be also in the way people have used the building. As you can see, there's a big screen above us, and this screen we're showing each of these buildings as they are today. The models show the way they were, and the screen shows the way they are. And the Moroccan genius is, of course, you have allowed these things to happen, but also to see how they've been transformed, they've been swallowed, they've been metabolized into some really strange things. So I guess the Moroccanness is in the way we transform these models and not the way they emerged.
Rem's been quite sort of open about the fact that he wants to use this Biennale as an opportunity to comment on the state of contemporary architecture now. How did you react to that? Are you involved in that commentary?
I think we are, simply by the fact that we've proposed a contemporary dimension to the pavilion, and I think there are very few countries who've done that. And we've proposed a contemporary dimension in a link with the historical part. And I think the architectural field moved from being fascinated from history to being fascinated about geography. The sliding between history and geography for them is symptomatic of the loss of sense. And that's the reason why for us the contemporary part of the exhibition is the next step of the historical trajectory in a way. If Rem's position is that there is a crisis in the contemporary architectural field, our position is that it's not so true.
What do you think he means by that?
I don't know what he means, and I don't think he does. I think it's just a weird feeling of uneasiness. And he's using this Biennale as a way to photograph the diagnostic. I don't think this is a cure. This is really diagnostics. And I think after this, we'll be able to get a sense of where we all are collectively. But it's both a very generous project from him, as well as a very personal and perverse approach.
Because I just get the feeling walking around, there's kind of quite a feeling of lamenting what's lost. There's not that sort of dynamism in architecture there was in the modernist period.
Well, that's exactly the opposite of what we're saying here. I mean, this is all about the Moroccan Movida. There's an energy in the country. There's a cultural transformation. I mean, I've been working there for the past 15 years. And everybody who works there has the feeling of participating to something new and exciting. And in that case, it's almost like the continuation of the modern project, which is what we're trying to stitch here, essentially. There's two gaps we're trying to overcome. The Second World War, where not much happened, and everything that happened after the mid-80s. And past these two hurdles, there's a fantastic continuity to the Moroccan trajectory in architecture. And I think it's a lesson for the rest of the world.
And also, it's the first time Morocco has participated in the Biennale. What sort of pressure does that involve for you helming the project?
The pressure is the one we create for ourselves, because the Biennale being the greatest event in architectural culture, obviously we're interested in the feedback we get from our fellow architects. But I can't say that there's a huge amount of pressure from Morocco. I think once they decided that we're going to ask us to do the creating for the project, they were interested in the approach we were going to propose. They weren't very directive, and I don't think they had any expectations yet. I think it's going to be much harder for the next guy. The first time is always the easiest.
That was architect and urban planner Tariq Ouloulou at the Morocco Pavilion, bringing us to the end of this episode's coverage of the exhibition. This landmark Biennale runs until the 23rd of November, and we highly recommend a visit. Keep your eyes on monocle.com this June for two special films we've done on the show. We'll be back after this with the team at the Lisbon Architecture Triennial.
At Grundig, we carefully craft equipment to help you make the most out of your kitchen, which is why we named our new oven and hob appliance collection, We Care. Our multi-taste oven uses three currents of hot air to cook different dishes simultaneously, with 13 cooking functions to choose from and an LCD display. It's one example of how we strive to perfect our technological innovation so that you can enjoy your home, meal after meal. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
This is Section D and I'm Tom Morris. We're moving away from Venice now, but staying in architecture. Following the success of last year's edition, the team behind the Lisbon Architecture Triennial are taking on a 2,000 square metre palace as their new abode. With the help of architect Margarida Gracia Nunes, the Triennial plans to turn it into a living headquarters, hosting exhibitions, talks, social spaces and even project residencies in its attic. Simon Tarek takes a tour with the architect of the building to see how its metamorphosis will be executed.
A dilapidated palace is not such a big deal in Lisbon, where dozens of grand buildings are often left in disrepair. But one of them, Palacio Sinel de Cordes, has recently been given to the city's Architecture Triennial as its headquarters. The woman in charge of its renovation into a living, breathing hub for architectural thinking and research does not want to transform the 2,000 square metre site. On the contrary, Margarida Gracia Nunes is on a subtle rescue mission.
This is a very interesting challenge for an architect in the 21st century, because we have more than a century of writings and reflection and, of course, architectural projects that are related to existing buildings. And we have a lot of theories about what to do, being it the conservation, which is the more radical one, not make any intervention, or must it be restoration, which is, let's imagine how the building was, and so let's put it how we think it was. And we have that current intervention in existing buildings that is reuse, but destroying what is there. The first time we came here, it was more than 2 years ago. We are talking about the building, and we began to look at the building as it is, and began to understand that it was a pity to lose all these marks of time and of the different occupations, and that perhaps we could make experiment of another way of looking at a building like this one, if this moment of the occupation was just another moment of this history of the building itself.
Originally built as a family residence, which Margarida rightly says was a large concept for 18th century nobility, Sinel de Cordes has in its time housed Supreme Court judges, royal Italian diplomats, and a public primary school. In 2016, it will host some of the many exhibitions, talks, and events organised by the Architectural Triennale, where director Manuel Enrich and his team will be based permanently.
We always wanted to be an institution that is a reference for architecture in Portugal. We really think that physical place, an HQ, as you say, will definitely help. It will be not only a place for tourists and for passers-by, but for a local that lives here and, okay, why not going to Pinali's library or bookshop? We will gather information that we have been collecting, and we will have partners sending us books or magazines. All the material that we gathered already from 2013 and from previous editions, and the main floor will be used as well for programming. And the attic will be for other people that want to join us here. You have to apply with a project, but we're bringing in the one that can also contribute to the palace and to the activity of the palace.
One of the things that is very interesting in this palace is the quality of daylight. It comes inside reflected by the shutters that are not totally white, so the light comes very strong from south, but it is kind of attenuated. Of course, we take informed decisions, but we must convert the decisions we make in technical issues, and so that's why I am talking about technical details. This is the model for a sanitary installation for the public, which is going to be located in the next room. And what we decided was here you have two windows that receive light from the garden. Here you have the entrance door. You come inside and you have one and two sanitary compartments. Then you go around this element and you have other two in here. All this element is in mirror. And so what happens is that it will reflect all the room and will reflect the windows and the trees that exist in the garden. Well, this is an object, and perhaps at least for the moment, one of the interventions which has more defined design and definitely a new design. This element in the center of that room will be a very strong element and will show that the palace is being lived nowadays and not two centuries before. It is a kind of an affirmation that we have been there in 2014. Toilets are places where usually there is a lot of experimentation. But for the architects and the designers, I've come to that conclusion.
When Sunel de Cordes is finished, with the flaky classroom blue on its interior walls sealed rather than painted over, the aesthetic results will obscure just how much consideration and respect is going into its renovation. As the Architectural Triennial prides itself on sharing architectural thinking with its city and its citizens, this palace looks to be an appropriate base. For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Saima Tariq.
Austria is renowned for its classical and Art Nouveau architecture, but its more recent building activity is also gaining increasing attention. Emerging Austrian architects like to experiment, and bold new buildings are now duly cropping up all over the country. Among the several domestic events where architects and designers can meet with the public and exchange some honest feedback is the biennial Architektur Tage, or Architecture Days, festival. The All Austria event was held last month and featured guided tours to listed buildings and construction sites, as well as open-door sessions at some of the nation's biggest architectural offices. Our Austria contributor, Alexei Korolyov, went along for Monocle.
I'm on a tour inside an imposing early 20th century bank building in central Vienna. This is where Austria's aristocracy used to keep their money. Today, the guide says, this fine example of Jugendstil architecture is, like many others, neglected and ignored. Some of the fellow excursionists around me shake their heads in dismay. This can't go on like that, one woman says. What can be done to stop it, she asks.
And while, of course, there is no easy answer to that one, it's this very questioning that the people behind the Architektur Tage Festival are hoping to provoke.
Architektur erleben bei Österreichs größter Veranstaltung für Architektur und Baukultur.
Well, the point is giving people the possibility to see architecture firsthand and have the possibility to discuss it.
Iris Meder of the Austrian Society for Architecture is co-organizer of the event.
This time is a little bit different because the motto is alt jetzt neu, old now new. So it's also about transformations of functions, of dealing with protected buildings, which of course is the case in the entire center of Vienna, which is UNESCO World Heritage Zone. So architecture surrounds you all the time and is a concern of the entire society and not only of architects and art world.
Servus, wir sind also Querkraft. Das ist unser Büro. Welcome.
And as I visit several Viennese architectural offices, all of them open to the public for the occasion, it quickly turns out that this festival is as much about politics as it is about the art of planning, designing and constructing. This is the offices of AAP Architekten, and I'm with its founding head, Franz Resner.
We want to discuss the position of common welfare in uses like a kindergarten, for example, like a music school, like something for elderly people, a place to meet in the city, in the ground levels, so in the shops or stores, parts of the buildings, they are close to the street or to the open space. And it's more private investors now, which means, for example, that our schools, they are built now in Vienna, are done by private companies and rented by the community. I think the main buildings for the main things we need in society should be owned by the society and not by private owners. One solution, I don't know if it works, would be to force them by law. The other thing is that this change has to be done also by the people in our minds. That means that we can't earn money with everything we own anymore.
Such a strategy, Resner argues, would help Vienna retain its ethnic and social mixture, which he describes as key to its peaceful and laid-back lifestyle. Another thing he wants changed is the relationship between architects and construction companies.
It comes to a sort of planning now that the architects are used only for design and pushed out of the whole planning process, which means for the design that at the end it doesn't look the way we thought it should be. We go in a competition for building a student home, for example. And we means 20, 30, 40, 50 different architectural teams. They don't get any money. Only the winner gets the project. So from the economical point of view, it doesn't make sense for us to do it anymore.
Now to another campaigning group, IG Architektur. Several of its members are standing for election to Austria's Chamber of Architects, and this is one of its final pre-election get-togethers. IG Architektur spokesman Patrick Jaritz told me why he decided to take part in the Architektur Tage Festival.
Architektur Tage is a great event for communicating architecture. It's on a level which is interesting also for professionals and for laymen. So we are also right now in an election campaign. We are there with our own, party.
Jarit says IG Architektur needs representation in the chamber to be able to address the many problems facing Austrian architects today, to everybody's benefit.
One thing is the payment of architects in general. Like, this is a bit out of balance now, the effort and the money architects get paid for this effort. But there are also other issues, like we are dealing with more and more unfair competitions. Another big issue are the building standards. So there's a huge flood of standards regulating the whole planning process, and they have a huge influence and not in the best way. So this is something we really have to discuss with the standards institutes. Architecture is something that concerns everybody, because how the built environment looks is something that has an effect on the well-being of people.
We work for everybody. As you see, there are lots of people outside. We see through this window queuing up for our a public bath tour, and they are not architects. They are just people who have heard about Architekturtage, and this is the audience we want.
Organizer Iris Meder of the Austrian Society for Architecture, the ÖGFA, again.
Do you think that you have a mission to change Austrian society for the better?
I think we definitely do, yeah. And this is, I would say, this is what the ÖGFA has been done since it was founded in 1965, with a limited success. I must admit, but we won't stop trying.
For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thanks, Alexei. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Section D. Today's show is produced by Alad John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Alad at awj@monocle.com. I'm Tom Morris. And playing you out as our trip to Venice closes, here's something to raise an Aperol spritz to. Roisin Murphy with Ancora 2. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Ancora tu. Non mi sorprendo, lo sai. Ancora tu. Ma non dovevamo vederci più. stai. Domande inutili.